We're ready, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I may have pleased the court. My name is Matthew Engel. I'm here this morning on behalf of the appellant, Russell Brown. Mr. Brown could not and did not receive...
Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I intend to reserve a couple minutes, 2 minutes. We'll see how it goes. And moots, I've been going over, so...
All right, 2 minutes.
We'll see how it goes. Mr. Brown could not and did not receive a fair trial in Didwinny County. I'm hoping to reach our venue claim. I have a lot to say about that claim. But I want to start by touching on two of our other claims because I think they present clear and obvious reasons that this case has to be reversed and remanded for a new trial. The first of those claims is our claim one, the denial of the provision of grand jury information to Mr. Brown. Our starting point on this claim is to note that on brief, the Attorney General does not take the position that Mr. Brown was not entitled to the information he sought. The information that he sought was the pool of grand jurors from the year in which he was indicted, 2013, and preceding years.
Well, actually, it was a five-year, the position that was, as I read the record, was it was a five-year block. We need 5 years of grand jury information. It was never, we need the year in which he was indicted. We need 5 years.
That's correct. And those 5 years, of course, included the year in which he was indicted.
2013.
Now, the Attorney General has taken the position, now I actually disagree with this position, that it would have been permissible for the court to say, I'm not going to give you all 5 years right now. I'm going to give you the year of indictment. If you can show me underrepresentation in the year of your indictment, then maybe we'll go a step further and provide additional years so you can investigate whether there are systemic underrepresentation on the grand jury.
Right. But in fact, when the trial court said, all right, I'll give you a year, 1 year, because this is protected information, and following one of the cases, you get the year of the trial, which of course would apply to the petty jury. But the defense did not say, wait a minute, if we're going to get 1 year, make it 2013. That's really what we're focused on. Instead, it was 5 years, 5 years. And so the court never perhaps grasped that it was 2013 that really was the focal point.
Well, I can't agree with that. And I think the reason we know that the court was clear about what Mr. Brown wanted was he said so in his ruling. And if you look at pages 182 and 183 of the joint appendix, the circuit court issued a written ruling. He didn't rule from the bench. He published a letter, as was his practice in this case, in which he denied the motion. And what he said in that motion is, no precedents have been cited that would allow defendant to obtain grand jury information from previous years. He said, I believe existing case law indicates the defendant is entitled to the jury list for the 2016 term in which his case is tried, or will be tried, this was in the future at that point, and no more. I agree with the Commonwealth that defendant's request is not obligatory under current law, and I am not prepared to go beyond that. The trial court judge understood very clearly that Mr. Brown was requesting grand jury information from both the year of his indictment and surrounding years. The trial court simply ruled erroneously that he wasn't entitled to that under existing law, and he denied it. There is, of course, no requirement for defense counsel to do anything for beyond that to preserve the error. The rule that you have to note your exception to a court's ruling has been abolished, and I would refer to Section 801-384 of the Virginia Code, which this court has applied in many, many criminal cases, which says that it shall be sufficient that a party makes known to the court the action which he desires the court to take, and his grounds, therefore. That's exactly what Mr. Brown did in this case. He said, hey, I want those grand jury lists, and here's why I want them.
Counsel, let's talk about the underlying cases that you're relying on. You're relying on Eccles and Prieto. And let's take Eccles first. In terms of that, that's a per curiam that indicates that it would be 1 year that you would be entitled to. What is it that you can look to or present to the court that would be the basis for expanding beyond that?
You would show underrepresentation in that 1 year. So you would take the demographics of Dinwiddie County, you would compare that to the pool of jurors for that year, and you would look for underrepresentation, be it racial, gender, or
other. No, I understand that. I'm saying what is there anything that you're putting forth in reference to that in terms of the underrepresentation?
Well, we can't put anything forth because we were denied the information. There's no way to investigate a claim of constitutional underrepresentation, of discrimination in the grand jury, other than providing those lists. That's why it's clear reversible error to deny that information.
If the grand jury had been unrepresentative for one reason or another, whether intentional or just happenstance, for 4 years and 11 months of the preceding 5 years before the indictment, but wasn't with the grand jury that indicted, would there be any violation at all?
Prieto says there would not. Prieto says you have to show underrepresentation in the grand jury that indicts you, and you have to show a pattern of underrepresentation.
Okay. Well, then, at any point, did the defense raise, okay, well, at least give us the grand jury that indicted us?
Well, in their initial request, where they requested the information and they explained exactly why they wanted it, they're not required to do anything beyond that. That's the statute. That's the law. Maybe there could have been an opportunity for more discussion. There wasn't. They received a letter from the judge that said, "This is what you're entitled to, and no more." The judge's ruling, again, I have to go back to that. He makes it clear. I know what you want. You just can't have it, and you can't have it because the law doesn't authorize it, and that is not the law. That is a rule of law that would enable discrimination to occur in grand juries and forever go undetected. It's a violation of the Constitution, and it's a grounds for reversal. There is only one remedy identified in the law for this error, and that's in the, I'd say, Eccles, I don't actually know, but that remedy is a remand for a new trial, and that's what it falls upon this court now to do, because Mr. Brown was constitutionally entitled to this information.
Does it make a difference if it's a grand jury list versus the petit jury list?
It makes a tremendous difference. They're two different lists. They're two different pools.
Well, right. Okay.
So he was given information, in other words, that was utterly irrelevant to the claim he was trying to investigate and develop, which was underrepresentation on the grand jury. He had an independent constitutional right to investigate that. It was denied by the trial court's ruling. I also want to touch briefly on Claim 3A, which is the seating of Juror Palmer. Juror Palmer was a biased juror. Juror Palmer said that the news about this case, it was in the news every day. She said it was everywhere. That was her language. When asked if she had an opinion, her quote was emphatic and it was clear. She said, "He did it." That was her words. "He did it." She gestured at her heart at one point during voir dire and said, "That opinion is right here now." She was not ambiguous at all about the strength of her opinion and what her opinion was. Her opinion was that he did it. If that's all she had said, this might be a close call. But that's not all she said, and this isn't a close call. She said two other things that are immediately disqualifying from service as a juror. First, she said that she was going to base her decision both on information that she heard in evidence during the trial and on information that she had received pre-trial through media and through conversations with other people. She said that clearly. She said, when asked directly, "Are you going to consider both?" She said, "Yes, I'm going to consider both." There was no rehabilitation whatsoever on that point. Second, she said that until it's proven otherwise, her opinion is that Russell Brown is guilty. She wasn't rehabilitated on that point either.
Did she say he did it or he's guilty? Because those are two different things given a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. There's no contest that he did it.
Well, of course, at that point, there's been no evidence presented. There is no defense has been presented at that point. And a juror who comes in with the opinion, "He did it, this man did it," is not an impartial juror.
Well, except no one contests that he did it.
Well, no one ultimately may have contested at the trial, but we're not at that point.
Well, right, but hadn't notice of the insanity defense been given? I mean, it wasn't something that the parties were contesting at that point.
Well, that's true, but it was pre-trial. And Mr. Brown was entitled to a jury that was free from fixed opinions about his guilt. It's not just a matter of
right, but I guess the question is, can a rational fact finder hear he did it and not hear he's guilty? Because to me, I can understand how you can argue that they're the same thing, but they're not the same thing, are they?
Well, that's certainly how the judge understood it, because what the judge said is that the juror did have an opinion that he was guilty. He ruled that it wasn't a fixed opinion. Our claim is that was error for two reasons. One, because she burden shifted. She was going
Counsel,
to...
let me stop you on the burden shifting.
Yes.
Where is that exact objection preserved? You've got the general bias, but you would admit that burden shifting is something different, correct?
Well, I think they're very closely related.
But they're different.
The argument that defense counsel made was that...
But they're actually different premises of objection in reference to seeing a juror, correct?
Yes, and I'll be glad to pull a precise page number for you, but defense counsel did say to the trial judge that one of the problems here was that Juror Palmer was going to require Mr. Brown to prove his innocence. She was going to require him to present evidence to rebut what, in her mind, was a presumption of guilt. So I think it's very clearly submitted. I will get a page number
for you. Yeah, I'm just asking for where it's actually preserved in terms of that particular point.
I will get you a page number if that's okay, Your Honor.
Sure.
The jurors' answers in these questions are very similar to the jurors' voir dires in the Justice and the Breeden cases, both of which are discussed extensively in our briefs. I won't belabor them. But the Attorney General has really made no effort to distinguish Juror Palmer from the jurors who were at issue with that case. I would ask the court to take a look at the voir dires in those cases and see for yourself that the Juror Palmer's responses are very much in line with those cases.
Although she did say her opinion would not interfere with her ability to hear the evidence and decide the case.
To hear the evidence, yes, Your Honor, but of course hearing the evidence is not what qualifies a juror.
Well, hear and decide.
hear and decide, but she has to be able to disregard her prior opinions. And she said the opposite of that. What she said is that I'm going to consider both what I heard before and what I'm going to hear at the trial. Yeah, she was going to hear what came at the trial. She wasn't going to plug her ears and refuse to hear it. She was going to hear it, but she was going to combine that with evidence that, or with not evidence, information that she had already obtained pre-trial, and she was going to base her decision on both. And her view very clearly was that he was guilty at that point. There was no presumption of innocence.
But then given what the defense that's put on, that he did in fact do it, I mean, it's not contested, how is believing that he did it harmful? Unless he did it means guilty.
Because this is a question, number one, of Mr. Brown receiving a fair trial. It's also a question of public confidence. We can't have jurors who are coming into the courtroom saying, I have a fixed opinion that this man is guilty and I'm going to preside on this trial.
But that's begging my question. My question is, assume for a moment that he did it and he's guilty do not mean the same thing, that they are distinct and different concepts. If he did it simply means he is the agent who pulled the trigger and caused the death, not legally guilty, is there any harm here?
I would argue that there is harm. That is still an element that's before the jury. And the main point I would make to Your Honor's question is that's not the way the trial judge understood this juror's responses.
But we're looking at it at the end of the day. The end of the day, can we say that a belief that he was the agent who pulled the gun had any adverse impact on him at all if it does not equate to he's guilty?
I think that, yes, the juror with a predetermination on that issue is not qualified to say it. Absolutely. I think that there needs to be a reversal on that basis. I'll very briefly touch on our change of venue claim. It's a big claim. I could talk for days about it. Obviously, I don't have that opportunity here. If ever a case demanded a change of venue, it was this case. I don't say this to be flip. This is a very serious situation, but as I was preparing this argument, a colleague made the comment that this is like having a trial in Mayberry for the killing of Andy Taylor. And I thought, you know what, that's a really apt analogy because Dinwiddie is a small rural jurisdiction, and Trooper Walker was a pillar of that community. He was a dedicated and beloved public servant. He was a wonderful person by every account, and his death was a tremendous and personal loss for the citizens of Dinwiddie County. These jurors knew Trooper Walker. There's media, and we talk about the media in our brief. I'm not going to dwell on it too much here. What I want to dwell on here is these jurors had a personal connection to Trooper Walker. He protected them. They knew him from his work. They worked with his wife. They went to school with his daughters. This was a personal loss, and that's why you see so many of these jurors came to the stand and expressed strong opinions of his guilt. This was an angry, saturated community, and the talk was everywhere. There are amazing quotes from some of these jurors in voir dire. They say everybody talked about it. You couldn't hardly avoid it. It was a mass media frenzy. It was blasted all over the media, so you had no choice but to pay attention to it.
But there's a presumption that works against you on this as a starting point, correct? That there's a presumption that a fair jury can be seated in the jurisdiction where the crime occurred.
But why that presumption is rebutted here, Your Honor, is because no fewer than 50 jurors, 50, took the stand and said that they had a preformed opinion that Mr. Brown was guilty. 35 said that. 15 expressed other bias. 50 out of 94 jurors who were questioned, 53% said that they were biased or had a preformed opinion. That's higher than any case that has been cited by either party in this litigation.
But if the jury comes from the other, the 47% that don't, doesn't that solve the problem?
No, because and the case law is very clear on this, that you do not look at the ultimate composition of the jury, you look at the ease of seating the jury. And in this case, over half of the jurors were struck because of their bias and their preformed opinions, or they expressed
on the standard
opinions.
Of ease of sitting a jury, the trial court had made provision. Progress was made each day. It was a methodical exercise that they went through. There were no days when no one was qualified. It was a steady progression that was well done.
That's true, but this was a six-day jury selection, which is longer than the Muhammad case, either the D.C. sniper cases, the Bob any other high-profile case you want to point at. This was longer, and
the O.J. Simpson case.
And I don't know that one offhand, Your Honor.
It was longer than 6 days.
Okay, well, it was also in California.
Fair.
I'll grant you that. You're in your rebuttal time, which is fine. It's up to you.
I'm just going to use it now.
Okay.
Because the point I want to make is that the trial judge and the attorney general both make the argument that, the reason this was so long and complicated is we asked all these other questions. I would like the court to look at the record. 40 of the jurors who were questioned were not asked a single question by defense counsel during voir dire. This was not a case of prolonged, protracted questioning. This was juror after juror. 44 jurors were questioned in under 300 pages of transcript. They came to the stand and they immediately admitted that they had opinions, they were biased, and they were unqualified for that reason. That is the essence of a difficult sitting in a jury. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Murphy?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth. First, on the grand jury request, this issue is completely waived. The assignment of error in this case is that the judge erred by denying the 5 days. There never was a request for any particular year. In fact, in the original letter that the defense sent, they said they wanted the, this is in 2015, wanted the lists for the preceding 5 years.
Well, isn't that implicit that there's a specific date or dates that are requested?
No, what
you're saying for the preceding 5 years?
Well, the preceding 5 years included 2014, which, of course, you know, they're now arguing would have been irrelevant to their consideration. They could only, that they had, the argument on
but,
brief.
But the 5 year range would have included a year that, to the extent the argument is tenable, you concede would be a relevant year. It would contain the year of indictment.
Yes, and that's something that they could have pointed out, that in fact they wanted a particular, if they were going to get 1 year, they were entitled
Counsel,
to.
I think their point is that it wasn't done maybe with the specificity that you're indicating is required, but that it was done and that the court was on notice about that.
The court was certainly on notice, but they were on notice they wanted all 5 years, and they explained why 1 year would not be enough. They said 1 year wouldn't do it. We would need the other years to perform our computations and able to satisfy the requirements under constitutional law that, in fact, there was a problem with underrepresentation of minorities. And that's, and if they'd asked for that, you know, the claim, they say on brief that they asked for the the year of indictment and preceding years. They did not do that. If they had done that, I think it would have been clear they would have gotten the indictment year, but not the preceding ones. But they didn't ask for that. They asked for the preceding years in 2015, which would have included that year, but also would have included subsequent years and previous years. And I think that what we have is a request. I mean, the judge says you're entitled to 1 year. They don't say, judge, if that's true, we want this one. We want only the year of indictment.
If they had only had the grand jury that indicted him, and it did not match the racial makeup of the community.
Yes, sir.
Could you see the Commonwealth arguing that doesn't show intentional discrimination? That could have just been who was available that week. It's random chance.
Yes, sir.
And if you're going to make, and if that argument would have been a viable argument for the Commonwealth to make, then definitionally, don't they need more than just that grand jury? If the argument...
Well, what the court said in Prieto, in dealing with the same issue with respect to the petty jury, was they should get that 1 year. And if they can then come back to court and show the possibility of discrimination, they can get previous years. But they can't get the present and previous years all at once. They have to make a showing from the 1 year. And that's exactly what they should have done here. They
Counsel, is arguing, though, that the grand jury is equivalent to a petite jury, because that's what Prieto actually deals with, is the petite
right.
jury.
Yes, sir.
So would you indicate that the analysis in terms of how the information is to be determined is the same, or do you think it's different?
Well, I would think it'd be the same, that you, in fact, would look to the year of indictment and then point out that, look, there's a disproportionality of representation. In order to prove a pattern, we have to go back and get the previous years. And what they said in Prieto was that makes sense. But the court doesn't have to give everything at once, that they can give the first year. I mean, suppose they look at the year of indictment and there's absolutely nothing there. It, you know, matches exactly the population statistics.
It's to balance the need against the privacy interests.
Yeah, sure. That's exactly what they said in that case, is that even though it's not as bad as revealing who's on the...
If a defendant asks the trial court to order the Commonwealth to turn over all inculpatory and exculpatory evidence, just everything you have, but never limits the request to Brady material, never
Yes, sir.
Limits it to exculpatory evidence, could the trial court say, well, you asked for more than you're entitled to, so you get nothing?
No, Your Honor. But, I mean, that's not...
Well, how is that different than this if they are entitled to the year?
Well, they never said they were entitled to the year. They said, we need 5 years.
Well, right. So they asked for inculpatory and exculpatory. And my question is, do they have to then... Do they lose the ability to... Does the request lose its salience because they don't specifically limit it?
No, certainly would not, particularly if they came back and said, we're entitled to the exculpatory. If you don't, you're certainly entitled to the exculpatory. You have to allow us that. Here, all the defendant had to do was say, look, I want 1 year, but I don't want the year of trial. I want the year of indictment. Everybody would have been put on notice. I think they would have received that, but they didn't do that. And now they're arguing that the entire trial should be undone. And don't forget, the Commonwealth's attorney pointed out that she did not believe there was any demographic information in the grand jury lists. That, in fact, you wouldn't find out much with respect to race in those lists. So we don't even know that the...
Would it identify them to the point that I could figure out?
With substantial investigation, but it's not as if that it would do it alone, just getting to the list. And what I'm saying is that we don't know what's there. There's no evidence whatsoever of discrimination, and that in fact the defendant was refused 5 years because it was onerous, and was no evidence that it wasn't would help anything. He could have said, "All right, Judge, let me have that 1 year, but make that the indictment." But I think the main thing is that even in the assignment of error, the claim is not, I should have been given that year. It says, the judge erred when he refused to give me the 5 years. And that's what's before this court. Now, with respect to Ms. Palmer, an important case to both this claim and the change of venue claim is something you were addressing, Judge Russell. The case of Shiflett. It's very similar, and it's very important in this case because it involved the same situation. The defendant had committed a double shooting, double homicide, and didn't contest that, but did contest the sanity. He said he was insane. So you get the same things you have here. During an individual voir dire, the defendant moved to have Jervis Strzok, who had expressed an opinion on the shooting. They believed the defendant had done the shooting. And the court said it's unnecessary to reach that. They said any tentative opinions previously formed were that the shootings had been perpetrated by a defendant. But that fact was not in controversy. And the sole issue was sanity. In the context of this case, the responses to questions about who had done the crime or who had done the shooting was... distinguish this case from justice in the other cases. Now, in this case, during voir dire, the defendant had in fact asked had told several prospective jurors point blank that they would not be contesting the fact that the defendant had shot the victim. They also indicated several times during the voir dire that they would be raising an insanity defense. They sometimes said, well, we might raise one, or if we raise one. But they also, so it was clear that that jury, that the issue was not ever an issue in the case. There was an insanity defense notice filed. And then during voir dire, not with every juror, but with certain jurors, the defense counsel said, well, we don't deny the killing. We're raising an insanity defense. Can you accept the... And the sanity defense. And many people were, several people were struck because they could not accept an insanity defense. But the claim that somehow what they thought about whether he had done it was irrelevant, because as soon as opening statement came up, the defense counsel said, we are not going to present any evidence that the defendant did not do this crime. And they indicated they were going to go with the insanity defense. So the fact that Ms. Palmer may have had an opinion about whether the defendant had done it, that is, had shot Trooper Walker, was really irrelevant.
Well, counsel, assuming that it's preserved in reference to the...
It is not, Your Honor.
Well, I'm assuming that it's preserved in reference to the burden shifting in terms of Ms. Palmer's comments about evidence that Mr. Brown would have to prove. Do you want to comment about that?
Well, I mean, it wasn't preserved. If you look at page... And as you said, it's addressed only to the other issue with burden shifting. And I think if, in fact, you were to address that issue, she had already told the defense, the Commonwealth's attorney, that she could apply the reasonable doubt standard, that she would not hold it against the defendant if he did not testify. She was then asked about wanting to hear other evidence. She said she needed to know everything else, that she would have to hear from the defense. She would want to hear everything. But she then said that she could put aside her opinion and that she would be able to, that what she had previously said, she would not require the defendant to testify, would not require him to present any evidence, but that she would expect them to. And I don't think that at this point this could be considered a shifting of the burden. In fact, as she continued throughout that conversation, she said she could put aside her opinion, and that was, she said, because the defense counsel asked why. Why is that? Why do you say that? She said, because that was then and this is now. That, in fact, having had this opinion previously, she had some ideas. Now she was in court. She indicated she would follow the instructions with respect to the burden of proof. And I think that in light of that, and particularly in light of Shiflett, that there was no reason to believe that it would make any difference that she, in fact, at that point, knew that the defendant had committed the offense, as did every other juror, and that the Commonwealth, in fact, when the defendant admitted that immediately, there was no question that, in fact, he had done it as soon as the opening began, and the fact that she may have said, unless somebody tells me differently, I think he shot Trooper Walker. It seems to me that is not disqualifying in the case of this sort, because it doesn't make any difference.
Well, on the burden-shifting argument, given the defense that was ultimately used, didn't he have a burden to come forward with evidence regarding being not guilty by reason of insanity? It's an affirmative defense.
Right. And she had no problem whatsoever with the insanity defense. She said she had no bias against psychiatrists or psychologists. So with respect to that issue, she was not did not have any opinion. She didn't have any opinion as to his insanity or insanity. Her only opinion is that he had done it. And, you know, not knowing what the defense was at that point, she said, well, unless I hear something, I mean, I heard it, I know what he has done, and you have to show me differently. And I think it's almost if you observe a murder on television, for instance, live television. I mean, you could not put out of your mind the fact that you had seen the shooting and knew that the defendant had committed that act, and to say that, well, can you put that out of your mind? It's, you know, of course, hard to believe that anybody could actually do that. Forget about what you'd seen. Here they heard, she had heard everything about this crime, and now she says, unless you change my mind with respect to that, I will continue to think he did it. And I think that that's different from saying, well, the burden was shifted with respect to insanity merely because she said she wanted evidence that, in fact, he had not done it. Now, with respect to the venue, change of venue request, the Shiflett case again deals with that and did the same thing. The fact that it said the fact that there were a number of jurors who had expressed opinions about the facts was irrelevant here because, in fact, the issue, that was not the issue. And it's clear throughout that in addition to that fact, that really it's irrelevant what they knew about the crime, the coverage is accurate at defense when the motion was argued. Defense counsel could not point to any inaccuracies when the judge asked. She wanted,
well, except for what about the news telecast that indicated that the trooper said something along the lines of, can I help your brother?
Well, that's...
There's no degree of ability to prove that's accurate or inaccurate, but...
Well, I mean, but the point is that the, in opening statement, the defense counsel said, in explaining what happened, that Trooper Walker had pulled over to check on the motorist. So, I mean, I'm not sure how that's anything different. I mean, he had sort of assumed a statement, but I don't see how that has any effect, particularly in light of the number of items involved in the press coverage. It just came in two full volumes, I think, of the appendix. And here you have no inaccuracies by the press itself. You have any inaccuracies about Mr. Brown are insignificant, since the defense admitted that none of the jurors had known anything about Mr. Brown. And for those reasons, I would request that, unless there are further questions, that the decision be made.
Thank you very much. Mr. Engel, your rebuttal time is expired, so I'm not inviting, but I know that, and I don't remember what the issue was, but your colleague was searching for joint appendix page reference, and if you have that, we will take that.
I would agree with Ms. Murphy. Page 1898 is where I would say that the burden shifting objection is preserved.
1898, thank you. With that having been said, we will, in keeping with the court's tradition, we will step down and greet counsel, and thereafter
Sure.
And then we'll take a brief recess.
I think it's not before.